This is exactly right.
We are on Mayanatonomi Hill, which is the location of where Thomas Cornell Jr. was hanged.
So they would hang people where?
They would hang people at a place where everybody could see them as a warning. And they did that in England as well as in the colonial Americas.
Rebecca Cornell's relative, Carrie Nolte, has taken me to the spot in Newport, Rhode Island, where public executions used to take place.
And you'll see that also in Salem. In about 20 years, they did the same thing and hung them at the bottom of a hill, not on top of a hill, usually because the convicted would be in a cart and it just wouldn't make sense to haul everybody up there.
So who had a clear view here?
The town of Newport would have had the clearest view, and that time they had just decided to make Newport the sort of center of jurisdiction for the island. It had been Portsmouth previously, but they had just built a new jail and actually tried Thomas Jr. in Newport at what later became the White Horse Tavern.
In May of 1673, workers were building the gallows at the top of the hill. Thomas Cornell Jr. had been convicted by a jury in the murder of his mother, Rebecca Cornell, and he faced execution for it. But if you've closely read some of the testimony that convicted him, it seemed like, perhaps, Rebecca wasn't as scared of Thomas as she was of his second wife, Sarah Earle. A friend named Patience Coggeshall said this in her deposition about Rebecca. She was afraid there would be mischief done. Her daughter-in-law was of such a desperate spirit, for not long since, said she ran after one of the children of his first wife with an axe, but she, Rebecca, had prevented her from striking the child. And then Patience Coggeshall told investigators what the crux of this story is. Both Thomas and his mother felt trapped. Thomas, because his finances were tethered to his mother, and Rebecca, because she had made a grave mistake. Patience said in her deposition, she did not live with any of her other children because she had made over her estate to her son Thomas. If she had thought her son Thomas's first wife would have died before her, she would not have made it over to him. So many mistakes were made in this story. And now, 45-year-old Thomas Cornell Jr. was scheduled to hang on May 23rd, 1673.
The local authorities were making a point of this death, of this hanging. They were feeding the crowds, they were feeding the desires of the people, because supposedly 1,000 people came to watch him get hung.
So he is hanged, and tell me about the hanging. Is it well attended, I'm assuming?
So the whole town would have probably gone and seen this, because it was not just...
It was a social event.
Yeah, it was a social event.
Thomas wouldn't be alone on the gallows. A Native American man who had also been convicted of murder was scheduled to die on the same day. Executing multiple people at the same time wasn't unusual in colonial times. It definitely made for more of a public spectacle.
You know, 1,000 people by boat and by horseback? It's not like they were hopping on a train or in a car. They had to really go out of their way to... So they gave a week's notice, I think. It was Friday of the following week, and everybody came, and it was like in England. You know, when you think about it, you know, the quartering and dismemberment and heads on pikes and all of that, there was still that bloodthirsty, let me see, vengeance, let me get justice.
Thomas Cornell was executed that day, and he never admitted guilt. He refused to turn on anyone else, and he declared his innocence up until the end. He may have been a bad son, but he refused to say that he was a murderer. Portsmouth historian Gloria Schmidt says that this story has been written into the area's history books for more than 300 years.
There are a lot of interesting people that are related to this family. And all over Portsmouth, you talk to people and they say, that's my family.
The Cornells were influential and respected. And perhaps the colony of Rhode Island actually showed that respect by honoring the family's reputation in an unusual way after Thomas was hanged.
It's a hanging, and it would have been on Myantonomy, which is a very high point in Newport. And usually they would have just left the body there to rot. And the fact that they did take it down and they did bury it in the family plot kind of proves that somebody was at least a little sympathetic towards him and his family. The normal thing would have just let, you know, the birds peck at them or whatever, but they did not do that in his case.
We're assuming that was the fate of the Native American's body, but I'm not sure. After his execution, Thomas Cornell was buried in a grave with no ceremony, no real recognition.
We, in fact, know that they buried him as far away from the rest of the family, but they did honor his request to still be buried on that land. And that doesn't sound like he's all that bitter if he's still, you know, concerned about being with the family.
Let's talk more about that now. We mentioned it before, but Rebecca Cornell and most of her contemporary family members are buried in a little cemetery on their old property, out behind Joe Ochi's present-day restaurant, the Valley Inn. Today, though, Carrie Nolte and I were curious about what happened to Thomas Jr.'s body.
The most important question I have is this place haunted? Is it? It has to be. Bad stuff happened here.
Bad stuff did happen here.
You've had ghost hunters in here, right?
Yes, we have. Yes, we have. A lot of the shows had approached us, and we had always said no. And I grew up in this house. My family lived here for my sons. Two of my sons live here now still. But anyway, my mom always used to say that if there's anybody here, they like us. So, but we had always declined them. And then when COVID came, and we were doing very little business for months on end, Kindred Spirits happened to call, so it was opportune. So I said, come on down.
Remember, this building is built around the actual home where Rebecca Cornell was tragically burned to death. And it was believed that Thomas's body was buried somewhere on this property.
And so they came, and they spent a week here, and they hired a local guy with the ground-piercing radar to find Thomas's grave, and I saw it with my own eyes, you know. So
where is it?
Oh, he's right over here in the corner of the property under the driveway.
Really?
Oh, you didn't know that?
Will you show me on the way out?
He always maintained his innocence, and his last request was to be buried in the family cemetery. That was denied by the judge, because if I convicted you of killing a family member, I can't very well put you in hallowed ground next to them. Problem being, these were settlers. There weren't very many people on the island. They all had big chunks of land, and they all buried their people in their own property. So there was no such thing as a community cemetery to put them. So there was no place else to put him if not on his own land. So the judge decided that he be placed in an unmarked grave because he'd been convicted of a crime at the furthest point on his own property from the family cemetery.
The property was 100 acres back then, which is a large piece of land, so they would have been able to keep Thomas Jr. far away from his family, and now he's under a driveway.
The furthest point on the property is that corner of the property.
Oh.
He's 10 feet from West Main Road, and he's been there ever since. Wow. And I saw it on the guy's screen.
What did it look like? Was it a skeleton?
So he could see basically the outline of what...
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. Will you show us? I know you're busy.
Sure.
And an exterior door as well.
Okay.
Is the basement original or no?
Well, it's still got the stone foundation. Because they didn't build like they do now. They just rebuild and reuse.
Yeah.
You know? The crew from the show put that little cross there.
Oh, wow.
And he's right here.
And they put the little cross.
Yeah.
That must have been weird to see that.
Yeah. So yeah, this is where he is, and if you can actually see that, like the condos, that's where the cemetery was down there.
Wow.
Or is.
Yeah, that cemetery was rough.
Yeah.
That was, well, thank you.
Oh, you're
thanks
welcome.
For coming. So, yeah, this was great.
It was really great to meet you.
My pleasure.
Thomas Cornell Jr. was gone, buried not far from his family's home. But the suspicion centered on his family had not been buried with him.
So I don't know if you do know that Thomas Jr.'s brother sought to have Sarah tried for the murder.
That's the story I've heard too, that Thomas's brother pointed the finger at Sarah Earle, but because she never went to trial and there aren't any records, I'm not sure how reliable it is. The Cornells were likely very angry with Sarah Earle, who had come in and treated their mother poorly, so the rumor that William Cornell had her arrested seems pretty likely to me. Interestingly, Sarah wasn't the only person in that house drawn into the conspiracy.
Later on, I want to say in 1675 or 1676, she is charged, but there's no real record of it. There's just a record that she was charged and then she was let go.
Okay.
But they also charged at the same time a Native American named, I want to say, Wicopash.
I asked Carrie Moore about the Native American servant, Wicopash. It sounds like he had a history with the Cornells.
One thing I should say is that Wicopash was charged and found guilty of stealing from Thomas Cornell the year prior to all of this.
Okay.
Okay, and then remember that the night of Rebecca's death, when Thomas and Sarah discovered his mother's body, Henry Strait assumed that perhaps the body was that of a Native American. Thomas soon corrected him and identified Rebecca's body by her boots. But now it's reasonable to wonder if Henry Strait thought at first that it was Wicopash breaking into the home and seeking revenge or just stealing something. He would have been familiar with the house, after all, and he may have carried a grudge from being convicted.
So one of the reasons that he may have immediately jumped to the conclusion that it was a quote-unquote drunk Indian is that he had been stolen from before, and Wicopash was a servant of his prior.
That doesn't feel like proof of anything, but it is intriguing. It doesn't seem likely he was there to steal.
We don't think there's anything that's been missing in this case, right?
No, but in the sense that both Wicopash, the former servant, and Sarah were arrested, was there a conspiracy?
What she paid him to...
She paid him. She and Thomas paid him.
So that's a theory. William Cornell demanded that the pair be arrested and tried because he thought perhaps Thomas and Sarah had hired their former servant to break in and murder Rebecca.
Now, what they accuse her of is abetting. And I don't know how she could have done that. And they found later on the door was still locked, so somebody couldn't have come from the outside and come in because the door in her room was locked.
Do you mean the inner door?
No, there was a different door. It would have been a door to the outside. No strangers. And somebody testifies later on that they tried the door and it was locked.
Of course, if they had hired Wicopash to kill Rebecca, couldn't it have happened before dinner? And couldn't Thomas have locked the door behind him after he left? We'll never know. But I don't really believe that theory. According to the servants and the farmhands, no one but the family was in the house when Rebecca died. And I would expect that it would have been easy to hear or see strange visitors approaching or leaving a creaky wooden house. So how much do we believe the Cornells? And how much of our thinking is tainted by all the hearsay associated with the case, especially one unfounded rumor that we've already talked about, that cryptic comment supposedly overheard between Thomas and Sarah as he sat in jail.
You know, it was basically, I'll keep your secret if you keep mine, you know?
I'll keep your secret if you keep mine. So was this a murder for hire plot? Who knows? Anything is possible, especially because, really, only Sarah and Thomas actually knew what happened. Either way, it was impossible to prove, and Sarah Earle and Wicca Pash were ultimately released.
People were talking. People had stories. People had seen things. People had heard things. And they were sharing that information. And so maybe Sarah had shared what actually happened with someone who told someone else who told someone else.
Okay.
But they just didn't have the proof that they needed, or that the people that said something wouldn't be willing to testify, or perhaps even it was down to Sarah's father, Ralph Earle, being too powerful and too wealthy. And so they wouldn't go after her.
They tried their servant, and then 2 years later they tried her and found her innocent. Like, what was their obsession with punishing this family to the extent that they already hung Thomas Jr.? Now they go after their servant, he gets found innocent. Then they go after Sarah, she gets found innocent. Who had it in for them? Like, what were they trying to prove with all of that? Like, they didn't just let it go with the death of Thomas Jr.
The whole experience must have been horribly embarrassing for Sarah. Remember, she came from a prominent family, and we know that Sarah's life with Thomas was likely not what she had hoped for when they married.
He came from a very good family. She would have been used to having servants, and it's, I don't think she would have been used to that.
So finally, with Sarah's release, the community had decided to move on from the murder. But what happened to that property? Gloria Schmidt and I both want to know that. Who ended up with Thomas Cornell's 100 acres?
Well, I'm not quite sure who inherited it. I'm sure that it was a very thorny issue because the wills would have been not in place. The wishes of the family would not have been in place, because if he was considered a murderer, that should have gone to the town. It should have been the town's land. It didn't. And, you know, even in the 1890s and so forth, it's still labeled the Cornell Estate. So it passed down in the Cornell family in some way, but I'm not quite sure what that path would have been. But it stayed in the Cornell family for quite a long time.
Luckily, Carrie Nolte had some answers. It sounds like because her husband was a convicted murderer, Sarah Earle didn't end up inheriting the land or the house.
She didn't get it. There were provisions made for her children. It went to Thomas Cornell III. And at one point, there was some legal maneuvering done by his uncles for the property, but that was all resolved. So he went on to, you know, stay and farm and live, and was the progenitor of the Cornells in Portsmouth.
Thomas Cornell III, Thomas Jr.'s oldest son from his first wife, was 20 when his father was executed. In a way, it feels like with Thomas III taking over, Rebecca Cornell's original wishes for her grandchildren might actually have been fulfilled. Soon, we'll talk more about what happened with Sarah Earle, because it will continue to have tremendous effects on so many people. Stick around until the end, because this postscript is big, and it leads us into our next season's story. Here's a hint. There are another 100 years of murders in this family. But in this case, it's really difficult for me not to think that this was a wrongful conviction. And even worse, I think it was a wrongful execution. Local historian Ann Burns agrees, and she says that there's a lesson to be learned with the story of Thomas Cornell.
You know, it's kind of frightening. So I think that, our judicial system, with especially DNA evidence, forensic science, has come such a long way, even in just recent years, especially the DNA. It's fascinating, but it was like a gossip mongering festival against this guy. You know, they wanted to find somebody guilty.
Anne says that when there was no concrete evidence, the colony of Rhode Island relied instead on rumors and a ghost to convict a potentially innocent man, all because he treated his mother poorly.
But they just jumped to the conclusion, like, you know, they didn't like him. They obviously didn't like him. Some people did, but I mean, they just rounded up all the people who had bad things to say. You know, how many people have bad mouth? Don't bad mouth your mother-in-law. Like, I don't think that would hold up in the court of law right now, but you know.
This is what the Innocence Project in New York says. To date, we have helped free or exonerate more than 200 individuals, most of whom are from communities of color that tend to be more heavily policed, face persistent discrimination, experience poverty at higher rates, and are confronted with many more challenges in the criminal legal system. Reporter Maurice Chama with the Marshall Project says that Americans are now more aware of these sorts of instances of wrongful convictions. Witnesses can be wrong. Forensic science is fallible. And sometimes innocent people confess.
Absolutely. I think that an awareness of wrongful convictions has penetrated society. It's been a sea change in the last 20, 30 years. DNA started to emerge in the 90s. And then to me, there's these big capstones, like the movie Just Mercy gets released and it's in theaters across the country. And here's a story of an innocent man going to prison, going to death row, despite not doing it.
Maurice says that sometimes when Hollywood catches on to a theme of injustice, Americans will finally listen.
In the conversations I have with people across the political spectrum, we've reached a tipping point where there is an awareness of innocent people being in prison and that this is a tragedy and that this is not something we as a society want. But then the second question that immediately follows is, well, what are we going to do about it? And often the answers involve some real trade-offs. You know, it's tough to stomach the idea that restricting what law enforcement and prosecutors can do or creating more layers of court review would possibly let a guilty person out. I mean, that is something that is terrible.
My father used to say that he would rather see 100 guilty people go free than one innocent person be imprisoned. Hopefully, the solution isn't so dramatic.
It may be a risk we have to take as we fine-tune the system to make sure fewer innocent people go to prison. And so sometimes I get into this almost philosophical headspace with people where it's a little bit unsatisfying and it's hard. I mean, these are really hard questions that we have to ask. So I don't want to pretend that it's like, oh, we can fix a handful of things and then all the innocent people won't go to prison anymore and we'll only get the guilty people. Like, it's going to be a messy, hard process to get there. But it's one that I don't think we can safely ignore anymore because the evidence of these tragedies of wrongful convictions is just so in front of us all the time.
But the question at the beginning of this season was, why was a potentially innocent 17th century man railroaded for his mother's murder? If Rebecca Briggs Cornell had died today, a pathologist could have likely resolved Rebecca's cause of death quickly. The spindle needle, a suspected murder weapon, could have been tested for DNA or for prints. Hopefully, justice could have been more clear. So, was Thomas innocent? I personally think there's a good chance of it, but I'd like to check back in with people we've talked about throughout the season for their thoughts. Rebecca's descendant, Carrie Nolte, thinks no. Thomas might not have been the killer, but he was certainly culpable.
I mean, I'm just going to go into what I think.
Yeah, tell me what you think.
I think Thomas set her on fire. I think he set her on fire to cover up the wound.
So you think that he stabbed her, she's flailing around, and he takes like a shovel and puts the embers on her?
I didn't say I thought he stabbed her. I think that she was stabbed, but I think that Thomas is probably the one who tried to cover it up.
Here's the twist in Carrie's theory.
Who do you think did it, Sarah Earle?
I think it might have been the wife.
The pregnant wife?
The pregnant wife.
Well, why do you think it was her versus Thomas?
I think that, well, we have the report of her chasing with an axe.
Okay.
Her stepkids. She is reported to treat Rebecca terribly. She came from a very, for the time period, well-to-do, well-off family. She would have had servants to help her do things. She didn't have that in the Cornell household. She had to do pretty much everything herself. So she thought that she was going to be marrying someone who was coming into his own. He was going to be this great landholder. He was going to be the inheritor of all these things, and nothing. She got the life of the servants that she once had, essentially. She didn't even have her own room with her husband. She was living in a loft with her children and the servants. So I think that there is a lot of resentment going on there.
Carrie suspects that all of Sarah's resentment eventually became focused on her mother-in-law. And the hormones that come along with being very pregnant might not have helped.
That's not her mother. It's an old woman that just won't die. And this old woman that's in the way of what she thinks is hers.
We lead busy lives, and it's hard to remember all the subscriptions we're enrolled in. Even though we might not remember or use all those subscriptions, we're still expected to pay for them, and that feels like throwing away money. If this hits home, you're not alone. 75% of people forget their subscriptions, but Rocket Money is here to help. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions. They also monitor your spending and help you lower your bills all in one place. The process for canceling subscriptions couldn't be easier. It just takes a few steps in the app. No awkward phone calls to customer service required. Rocket Money even offers a concierge who will try and negotiate with your phone or cable provider to make sure you're getting the best rates. Join the more than 5 million Rocket Money users who have saved $500 million in canceled subscriptions. When customers use all of the app's features, that comes to about $740 of annual savings per member. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wicked. That's rocketmoney.com/wicked. rocketmoney.com/wicked. May is the official start of lavender season, but if you don't want to wait in line at some tourist trap to enjoy the beauty and fragrance of this majestic flower, grow lavender at home. Join me and 2 million other happy customers who shop at fast-growing trees year-round to find the perfect plant for any season or space. They're the largest online nursery in the U.S. with over 10,000 different plants, and they'll deliver everything to your door in just 1 to 2 days. Just an update on the Autumn Blaze maple tree that I got from Fast Growing Trees. I think the leaves have tripled in number over the past couple of weeks. We've gotten lots of rain. The tree loves it. It's so easy to take care of. I just check its moisture every once in a while and make sure everything's going well, and it's just exploding with new leaves. This spring, Fast Growing Trees has the best deals online with up to half off select plants. And listeners of our podcast get an additional 15% off their first purchase when using the code TENFOLD at checkout. That's an additional 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com when you use the code TENFOLD at checkout. Fastgrowingtrees.com and use code TENFOLD. Offer is valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions apply. Back at the Valley Inn restaurant, Carrie and I debate with Joe about what exactly happened that Friday night in 1673, right here in this house.
I'm a descendant of Rebecca Cornell,
okay,
from her daughter, through her daughter's line.
Okay.
So not Thomas Jr., but I think that there's probably a good chance that there was a murder and then a cover-up. I think that they burned her to cover the wound because it was so acrimonious in that household. Thomas owed her 100 pounds that he was refusing to pay, and he was withholding... Yeah. Withholding the rent. So it was very acrimonious, and the new wife, the second wife, mm-hmm, said some pretty wild stuff at the trial about a dog leaping out and that it was marvelous that most of her clothing wasn't burned.
I have read that, and I actually have the transcript of the trial somewhere.
Yeah, I've read that too. Yeah,
and the way I read that, I think her exact words were, a great black dog leaped out of the doorway at them. Yeah, I interpreted that as, and going back to some of the things from the Salem witch trials, that I know a lot of people believed that witches were shapeshifters. So, and that they revert to their true animal form when they die. So I interpreted that as her trying to claim in court that her mother-in-law was a witch.
I agree with that. I think she was trying to frame it in such a way that no one would really look further.
We asked Joe what he thought.
So you think it was a tragic accident?
Well, I would tend to lean that way. And I think Thomas got screwed. That's just from what I understand of it. I may be totally wrong, but to me, it points to it.
But there were other possibilities, according to Ann Burns.
It crossed my mind that one of the kids could have done it, or Sarah could have done it, you know, and that the parents were covering for the kid, or Thomas took the fall for Sarah. That has absolutely crossed my mind.
I've thought of that too. At least one of the kids from Thomas's previous marriage was a teenager, 13-year-old Edward, and he's the one who initially found Rebecca in her room. But Gloria Schmidt still believes that this was a horrible accident.
I think I err on the side of there was some accident involved. It was just so common for their clothes to catch on fire. There are too many things that don't add up.
What if Sarah Earle were guilty? Historian and TV presenter Nell Darby says that she wouldn't be surprised. The acrimony between Sarah and Rebecca would have been a very strong motive for Sarah to murder her mother-in-law.
I think for both men and women, there is a variety of motivations, but you do tend to find far more women committing these kind of emotional murders. You know, it's to do with relationships with other people. So jealousy is often cited as a common motive.
And there's the financial motive also. Nell says that maybe Sarah was jealous that Rebecca had so much control over their money.
So I've always seen lots of cases of jealousy and sort of women killing, say, their lover's wife or other girlfriend, jealousy towards their husband's lover's children. It all gets very, very complicated, but there tends to be sort of family reasons, jealousy, passion, that kind of thing. Whereas men tend to be different in terms of their motives. They don't tend to kill for the same reason.
According to Nell, men and women also tend to use different kinds of weapons.
You know, we've seen that they tend to kill with different means as well. You know, there's a lot of more explicit violence, you know, and kind of fists, you know, bodies. You don't even need a weapon. But where they do kill, it's kind of more likely to involve kind of that more explicit violence than women who traditionally have poisoned. But, you know, they do commit murders, but for different reasons and using different methods. And of course, women still tend to be far less represented as perpetrators of murder than men do.
But none of that matters now, because regardless of what happened to Rebecca Cornell, her son paid the price for it. Now, his family. What happened to Sarah Earle?
So she remarries.
Sarah went on and married someone else and had more children afterwards.
But let's briefly go back. You'll remember that Sarah was pregnant when Thomas died. After the girl's birth, Sarah thought about her new daughter's name. Women often name their daughters after themselves. Rebecca Cornell had named her own daughter Rebecca. Sarah had already done that for her 5-year-old girl with Thomas, but she made a decision about the newborn's name that would resonate throughout their family history.
Yes, Innocent. She named her Innocent.
That's a bold statement from Sarah. And Innocent might have faded into history along with the story of her father, except that Innocent went on to marry into a very prominent New England family, the Bordens. Lizzie Borden was Sarah Earle's direct descendant, the same Lizzie Borden who, more than 2 centuries later, would be suspected of taking an axe and murdering her father and his wife.
And that is the direct great-great-great-grandmother of Lizzie Borden.
Okay, big revelation. For some of you, this might be a little bit more evidence that murderous intent can sometimes run in the family. Is it a coincidence that Sarah Earle supposedly chased her stepson with an axe, and then her descendant used an axe to murder her parents, allegedly? Maybe. Luckily, we're able to trace a direct line from Sarah to Lizzie.
So Innocence had boys, right?
Yeah, Lizzie is in Innocence's line. So it's a very interesting family. You know, you have people that the founder of Cornell University is in that line too. So you have an awful lot of people, but there are other interesting, and I've come across Sarah in her second marriage to David Lake. And all these families are all interconnected. It's an interweaving story. So, you know, you find in other situations where, you know, somebody that was a son or daughter of Thomas Cornell comes into other stories of Portsmouth history.
The story of Thomas Cornell and Sarah Earle is still debated in New England today.
So you really feel like Sarah was the one who did this?
I think that Sarah was the impetus. I don't think that Thomas would have... I don't think it would have come to death.
Gloria Schmidt was involved in a theatrical play about the case in Portsmouth, and she says that the audience was always torn over what really happened.
When we did this play, we presented this, and then we asked the playgoers to be the jury. And, you know, quite often, I think we presented it about 6 times. And I think that in 4 of the situations, people voted that it was an accident. And we had one situation where they thought that it was something paranormal that happened, that hound from hell or whatever was, you know, involved in it. And only in like 2 cases did they say that they thought that Thomas was guilty.
At the end, when we review this story, it all comes back to Rebecca Briggs Cornell. She was a pioneer, a driven, family-minded woman who wanted to embrace her religion on her own terms. Gloria Schmidt says that when Rebecca first moved to New York, there was virtually nothing there.
It's just a plot of land. There's nothing around it, but they were granted land. So they had to start from scratch again, just like they had in Portsmouth. When the original colonists came into Portsmouth, there was nothing there. They first spring, they were in huts that were, you know, dug out with branches over them until they could cut down logs and things like that. And these were a lot of wealthy merchants. They had positions, and all of a sudden they were back and they had nothing. And they were starting over from scratch. So for her to be again starting over from scratch was tough.
But Rebecca survived it, only to tragically die in her own home, feeling unloved and unappreciated by her own son. As Rebecca had grown older, her outlook had become darker.
It's a tragedy about how little we did, and for the most part still do, in terms of mental health and mental health for women.
I asked Gloria Schmidt and Carrie Nolte what they think this story represents in history.
I think the lesson for this story for me is that it is very easy when we judge to take a lot of other extraneous things, like comments that the person who died might have made to other people, and I just see those blown out of proportion, because the actual evidence, that's not what he was tried on. The actual thing that he was tried on was people's interpretation and what she said about him as a son. And I think that he was found guilty of being a poor son. He really wasn't found guilty of the murder. But people are trying him for things other than that crime.
I think it represents
a woman, like you said, who was trying to do right by her family, who was being the grandmother and the grand dame of her family the best way that she knew how, and by personality and circumstance, found herself at odds with her son. And into that mix, I think you threw someone who was a psychopath.
Oh boy, Carrie Nolte's back next season because she's related to more killers, and we'll be talking a lot about them. And one of those killers was married to one of Sarah Earle's descendants. The woman lived right next door to the Borden home. Her house is said to be haunted, and her story was tragic.
Okay. And everybody's probably heard of Lizzie Borden. But there's another murder in a generation before her who descends from Thomas Jr. and Sarah Earle Cornell. And that is this very tragic story of Eliza Hathaway Darling Cornell.
Her married last name was Borden. Eliza Borden was Lizzie's great aunt. See you next season. Thanks for listening to this season of Tenfold More Wicked on Exactly Right. Check back in 1 week to hear the trailer for our new season, which premieres on Monday, May 13th. As always, thanks for coming back each week. We love our listeners. If you love true crime, check out my books, American Sherlock and All That Is Wicked. I also have an audiobook called The Ghost Club. I can't wait to tell you the real story about the world's most famous ghost hunter, who was the head of the world's most famous ghost club, and how he investigated England's most famous haunted house. This has been an Exactly Right Tenfold More Media production. Producer Jason Whaling, Senior Producer Alexis Amorosi, Consulting Producer Kyle Ryan, Researcher Nicole Brown, Sound Designer Eric Friend, Additional Sound Design by Nicholas Moonies, Composer Curtis Heath, Artwork Nick Toga, Executive Producers Georgia Hardstark, Karen Kilgariff, and Danielle Kramer. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Tenfold More Wicked.